If it sounds like I'm piping in some fake background noise, it's not true. The crickets, cicadas, whatever the noise is, we're in remote Arkansas. Is there any other part of Arkansas? It's Bull Shoals Lake. Never been. The water's beautiful. My wife had been here when she was a kid, so we got the kids down here doing some boating. It's about, what, 110 degrees out? Good time to be in the water, not out of the water for very long. But the Kilcoin Conversation this week, checking in with Rick Ankiel. And one of the things that fascinates me, in addition to the baseball story, is him becoming a broadcaster. I mean, wasn't a big media guy when he was young and coming up. But to be honest, a lot of the young guys aren't big media guys. And after everything he's been through, Ankiel has turned into, quite literally, an open book. He's written a book about his throwing struggles, his life, his times, the highs, the lows, and has been sort of re-embraced by the Cardinal community now that he's back in his broadcasting role. Just fascinating when you think about second-round pick in 1997, the MLB draft, USA Today Player of the Year in baseball, ends up being second in the Rookie of the Year in 2000, came up with the Cardinals that year, debuted in 99, but in 2000 was in the rotation, second in the Rookie of the Year voting to Rafael Furcal, and then the famous throwing problems during the postseason. Career's basically over. Walt Jocketty and others say, let's try it as a hitter. You're a great hitter. And comes all the way back and has that famous return to Busch Stadium as a Cardinal, as an outfielder, and paid his dues. He was playing in AAA, was a AAA All-Star before he got the call-up. It was August of 2007. Let's take a listen to that call. Dan McLaughlin, Al Roboski on Fox Sports Midwest with Rick Ankiel back in the big leagues as a hitter.
There has been so much interest in Rick Ankiel over the last few years. The way that he busted onto the scene and then trip to the minor leagues, conversion to it, an outfielder, and now back in the majors.
Well, you just told people have patience and realize that he's still not a polished major league hitter.
Chance here to make an impression, though, with two runners aboard at second and third. Count of two balls, one strike, 2-0 Cardinals.
Three, four, and nine.
Really, if you look at the first four, been in the order, no hits.
And Keel out to deep right field. Has a chance to leave the ballpark. It's gone! A three-run shot for Rick Ankiel back in the major leagues. Remarkable. 5-0 St. Louis. Remarkable.
Nobody's happier than Tony La Russa. And these fans are pretty happy along with him. His teammates are happy. But that's the thing. You make your pitches, you got a chance to get him out. You make a mistake, he's got that raw power, and he's going to get his first curtain call.
What an unbelievable moment. I think Tony La Russa has said, other than winning the World Series, that's his favorite moment, seeing Ankiel do that. And it got a lot of national attention. The guy who had been, you know, famously struggling to throw strikes, reinvents himself as a position player, comes back, ends up having a decent big league career as an outfielder. 3 years with St. Louis, ended up with the Royals, the Braves, the Nationals, Astros, and Mets. So after debuting in 99 as a pitcher, he was still in the big leagues in 2013 as a major league outfielder. Pretty incredible. So our visit with Rick Ankiel, this is from a recent Legends series interview. Myself, Brendan Weesey over at KTRS. They have a weekly Legends series. We've had a lot of great guests on that show. And occasionally we share them with you over here on the Kilcoin Conversation. And this one certainly stood out because Rick is so open and honest about the career. And like he's doing on the broadcast now with Dan, he just sounds very comfortable and talking about just about anything. The Kilcoin Conversation, as always, even when it's from the remote reaches of Arkansas. Are there areas of Arkansas that are not considered remote? A lot of winding roads down here, I will say that. But the conversation is brought to you, as always, by our good friends at B&G Tuck Pointing, the best in the bricks. And because I've gotten to know Rich Galati and his family, Bella and Gabrielle, I have to tell you, every time I look at a brick building now, I'm staring at the tuck pointing, wondering if it needs to be redone. You just sort of notice those things now. But it's beyond tuck pointing. They can do foundation repair, waterproofing. BGTuckPointing.com is where you can find out more, read some of the reviews to get a free estimate on that chimney, garage, home, whatever it is. Call Rich Galati directly at 363-0525. 363-0525. When you redo the tuck pointing, it makes the bricks look new and that makes the entire home look new. The best in the bricks, BGTuckPointing.com. Triad Bank, one of our longtime sponsors here, a real St. Louis success story. Started in St. Louis in 2005 and soon opening that second location, which means things are going well because they're taking care of people right here in St. Louis. The original spot will always be on Clayton Road in Frontenac. Always on the web at triadbanking.com. Whatever your needs are, personal checking, small business loans, talk to Jim Regna, the CEO. Anybody on the team there, great folks will help you do more business. It's Triad Bank. Appliance Discounters, where you can get those great General Electric appliances, GE. Get a great rebate, warranty, everything that comes with General Electric, that name that stands behind the appliances for so many years. And get it delivered quickly. That's what Appliance Discounters is all about. Getting you that brand new washer, dryer, stove. Get it in days instead of waiting a month or so. I know a lot of things are backed up right now. And the other guys might say, sure, can you wait a few weeks? Can you wait a month? You don't have to do that with Appliance Discounters. They have the 80,000 square foot warehouse in downtown St. Louis. They've doubled the size of it. So they have plenty of inventory to get it delivered directly. TheAppliancedIscounters.com. Or stop by any of their showrooms and find out why their savings are your savings. And Marie Davila Senior Living, corner of Clayton and Wideman Road, beautiful 60-acre campus. Take a virtual tour anytime at mariedavila.com. Assisted living, villa estates. Red Shandy's lived there for so many years, lived in one of the villas. Beautiful campus, that's really what it is. Senior Living at Marie Davila. All of these great Kilcoin sponsors. We appreciate them. Let them know you heard me talking about them on the show. But for now, it's time to hear from Rick and Keel, our visit on KTRS Radio. And we begin with being a phenom, what it was like when you're tagged for stardom at such a young age.
Well, at the time, I was working as hard as I possibly could, and you're growing to get better. And when other people recognize you in that way, it really made it feel like all the hard work was paying off. And to be honest, it just made me work harder. Because once you, I think that any player will tell you that they want to get to that, right? It's not all about that, but you want to get to that. That's a goal. You might as well be there, right? Shoot for the moon and you land amongst the stars. And then once you start to get that attention, you want to stay there and keep it. So for me, I use that as a driving force and just let it motivate me to continue to get better.
USA Today Player of the Year, in fact, 11-1 your senior year there in Port St. Lucie, ERA of 0.47. I know you're a really young guy at that moment, but that had to be cool. You pick up the paper and there's your picture, USA Today Player of the Year. Did you save that, by the way? I would have it over the mantle if it was my house, but what was that like seeing that?
Of course I saved it. Well, I'll start when I was a junior. So when I was a junior, and I went to I might have even been a sophomore. Regardless, I think maybe I was a junior. Anyway, I go to this tournament called Team One, and it's all the, best high school talent all in one place, and there's a bunch of scouts, and it's a showcase tournament. And I had an unbelievable tournament, really did. And there was a guy by the name of Ryan Anderson. He was like 6'9", 6'10". He's from Michigan. He didn't have a great tournament, but it was good. And when that tournament was over, they ranked me number 2 and said that he had a higher ceiling, which really pissed me off, to be frank. And honestly, it's the best thing that ever happened because I went home and just went berserk on working harder and trying to get to that number one spot. So when that, when the USA Today came out and I was listed as number 1, it was like, aha, I showed you. But like I said, man, really, it was a blessing in disguise. And then, like I mentioned before, when you start to get that kind of attention, a lot of those guys that were on that USA Today team, I played with some of those guys on the USA Junior team, so I was familiar and friends with those guys at this point. And it was just cool for all of us to be on that team, and then obviously to be ranked as the number one prospect at the time. It was incredible.
And to hear you mention the work, it's interesting because when people are phenoms, I think everybody just assumes you came out of the womb and, well, he's a great golfer. Well, he's a great baseball player. Must be nice. Must be lucky. And yet a lot of it is in the cage, on the mound, early mornings. And, you know, do you think people mistake the talent sometimes for the work that actually goes in with it?
I think it can be, especially back then. But I will say nowadays, I mean, you look around, and maybe you can mistake it, but the more you're around sports in the game, you understand how hard everybody is training. You know, it's not just an in-season thing anymore, and this is even for high schoolers, right? This is it's almost 24/7, 360 days a year. You look at how strong the athletes are these days, and all that comes with it. So I think that there's, like you said, I think it's easy to do that, but if you really dig into it and you've been around the game, you understand what it takes to be in those positions.
I would have never guessed Rick Ankiel, broadcaster. And we came down a few years ago. Scott Warman helped us set it up on the TV side. We came down to the studios, did an interview, talked about everything. And you just seemed comfortable. And now you're doing the games, and you and Dan sound great together. And I get the sense you're just yourself, right? I mean, how much transition has there been for you to get into this mode to be an analyst, and how much of it just feels natural?
Starting with pre and post, it's really about learning the mechanics of the camera, where to look, what segments what, kind of understanding what's happening, how they move in and out of stuff. And to be honest with you, the games are easier because you're just sitting up there and you're talking about what you see, right? There's a play, you analyze it, maybe what you think is going to happen. So really, there's mechanics to that too. Obviously, you want to learn your partner and understand kind of how he works. And, you know, there's some things with that. Try not to talk over the pitches in the middle of an at-bat. But really, I feel like once you learn the mechanics of it, it does feel pretty natural because you're up there just talking shop and having fun with the game. And that, I think for all analysts and broadcasters, you know, the one thing, especially guys who played, to remember that's helpful is you're never wrong because it's how I see the game, how I might have approached that play, and how I would have navigated through it. So that helps in being able to just talk freely and not feel like, well, it's a little bit different. Well, it's my opinion. It's how I see it. So it's been a lot of fun. Listen, I love working with Dan McLaughlin. It's like working with family. I've known him forever. When I came into the big leagues in 2000, that was really his start. In the big leagues, too. So, you know, it's kind of like we've been on this journey together, even though it's been separate roads.
Yeah, that's true. You guys were both kind of phenoms. Danny, really, on the broadcast side, too. And I wonder about being the headset, though. People don't understand. So I was doing Rams preseason football, and they would always have a former player, but they would be fresh out of the game, never had done TV. And the producer directors talked the entire time during football. And even when a player would go down, we'd be in the middle of a great conversation, and you'd hear, commercial, 10, 9. And then my guest, analyst sometimes, Ricky Prohl, goes, what's that, Martin, commercial? And I said, no, that's not for us to say. Have you had to get used to that voice in your head and how often they talk?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I mean about the mechanics of it, right? You got to get used to how these things are produced. It's a show. And then once you start to learn those type of things, it gets easier. But you're 100%, right? You're not used to someone talking in your ear while you're talking, and then all of a sudden you got to change directions. And like you said, they might start counting down from 10, which means wherever I'm at in my story, I got to zip it up in a heartbeat, and we need to move on. So not that you can't get back to it later on, but those are the things that I think you have to learn through experience. You know, you can tell somebody that's going to happen, but until you start doing it and getting used to it, you know, it's tough to navigate it at first.
Rick, what do you remember about your big league debut? It was late in the 99 season up in, a stadium that doesn't have a ball club anymore, up in Montreal.
Man, I remember being excited, like this is finally the moment. You know, you work your whole life to make it to the big leagues, right? That's everyone's first goal, I think, is I want to make it to the show. And you get that call, and it's a surreal moment, and, you know, you're calling your parents, your family, your friends. You know, I remember going to the clubhouse in Montreal, and you know, my brain was, your brain's spinning, right, about what's going to happen in the game, what it's going to be like, this, that, you know, everybody's telling you different things. And I remember we're probably 2 hours away from the game. And I'm an early riser, just always have been. So I actually fell asleep sitting in the chair, right? I remember waking up and they're thinking, and guys were like, oh, look, he's not even worried. Where the truth was, my mind had been going so fast for so long all day that I just got tired and needed a little, needed to shut my eyes for a minute. So, but I remember getting up there facing Rondell White. I ended up striking him out, and, you know, I grew up watching him. That's a big name for me. That was the leadoff hitter. And once that at bat took place, it felt like, okay, you know, I belong here and I can pitch here. And then, you know, I remember pitching to Vladimir Guerrero. Just some of the big names, your heroes that you've watched on TV, and all of a sudden you're on the same field competing against those guys. It's a pinch yourself type of moment because it's like, man, I've made it and all my dreams are starting to happen right now.
Rick Ankiel, our guest, Cardinals broadcaster, former Cardinal player, part of the Sports Legends here in St. Louis, brought to you by Royal Banks of Missouri. And Rick, when you first met La Russa, give me your blink. They say he's tough on young guys, but yet he almost from day one, I remember him talking about, he was like a son to him. I know you guys are still friendly, tight, whatever, but tell me about the first moment you met Tony.
Listen, I tried to act confident and cocky, but, you know, in the back of your mind, it's still Tony La Russa. And, you know, he's the head of the show. I mean, he runs it all, and, you know, it was yes sir, no sir, and, you know, some, he wasn't hard at first, but he's stern. I mean, I think everybody in St. Louis has been around Tony enough. He's going to let you know who's in charge real quick, right? He's going to take that role and make sure you understand that. And then after that, you know, like most people, I feel like as a young man or even when you're first meeting someone, when you show them respect, you're going to get respect in return. And that's the way that I approach that. So I was just so happy to be in a Cardinal uniform, to be, you know, on my way as a professional, because the first time I met him, I was still in the minor leagues. And, you know, I wasn't on the big league team yet. So, but just to be a part of it. And like, once again, you're looking around and you're seeing Mark McGwire and Jim Edmonds and Daryl Kyle and all these guys that are big leaguers and you've watched on TV, and it's like, man, I'm, you know, the goal is to be a part of that sooner rather than later, but you know you have to go put your time in too. So all in all, man, it was a great experience, and it was one of those things, like I said, where you're just like, man, I can't wait to get here and be playing under these guys.
You know, I had a recent interview with Will Clark, and we were talking about his brief period but yet electric 3 months that he had or whatever it was in St. Louis. And then I said, remember you would always make J.D. Drew get you a beer after a game? And he said, nope, it was Drew and Ankiel. They both had to do it. And he said, J.D. didn't like it, but Rick was fine with it. Do you remember that, where Will would be sitting back barking out?
His first game, right? So my locker was right next to him, which I think they did on purpose. So anyway, we come up to the everybody comes up to the clubhouse, and, you know, people start going their own directions, and all of a sudden I hear, Rookie, get your butt over here. So, like, somebody yells around the corner, Ank, Will Clark's yelling for you, you better go now. So I sprint over there, of course, and I'm like, hey, what's up? He's like, after every game, there better be two Budweisers sitting right here in my locker. And the first one, the label better be facing out, and the next one better be right behind it. I was like, okay, yes, sir. So every time the game went in, I'd sprint up there, and they had to be ice cold, right? I'd have to put two ice cold beers, and the label had to be exactly straight, or he would yell at me. It was pretty fun.
But he said you took it well, and he said nope, and JD did not like it, and that's fine. He's still.
Yep, that's about right. Like, but this like I talked about earlier, I really just tried to show all those guys respect. And to be honest with you, whether it was Eric Davis or someone else telling me to go get them coffee during the game, none of that ever bothered me. I kind of liked the hazing. It made me feel more a part of the team. And I'm happy to be here. I remember the first time I brought Eric Davis a coffee, sitting on the bench. I bring it to him, and he pours it out. Right when I gave it to him, he just poured it out. And I'm like, what's up? He's like, I take my coffee with one cream, one sugar. Now go get another one. So I had to sprint back up. But that's you know, you learn, and it only happens once. And then now when they ask, you know. So it was all fun and games.
You know, I saw Eric Davis, he, like, playfully, like, nuked a reporter, and said, what do you want to talk to me for, man? I didn't do crap today, whatever. And then the reporter turns around and leaves, and he just looked over and he winked at me like he was just messing with them. What a combination. Eric Davis, Will Clark. How about McGuire? Didn't he kind of take you under his wing a little bit too early on?
Yeah, he did. Everybody was great. They were fantastic. They really were. And I think that does go around with just showing those guys respect, right? I mean, they've earned their time. They've been there for 10 years plus, whatever it was. But yeah, Mac was absolutely fantastic. Matter of fact, I remember this is probably 2 months into my first big league season with McGuire, and I'm sitting at the table signing fan mail, and there was a picture of me pitching, and he walks behind me and he goes, hold on, don't sign that. I said, okay. So he took my pen and signed his name, and he's like, take that and send it to him. I bet they'll like that one. I was like, yep, I bet they will. So he walked off, I took it and put it in my locker. I said, I think I'll like this one.
Oh my goodness! What a time that was too, because the Cardinals were just about to really emerge into the decade, you know, of the 2000s, and you had so many just big names like that. How about Daryl Kyle and you being there as a young guy? He's been talked about so much as a mentor and a character guy. What was he like for you?
He was incredible. I mean, he really was. You know, really took me in and showed me what it meant to be a pro, what it meant to be a St. Louis Cardinal, how to act on and off the field. I mean, I was, you know, I'm just from a little town, was still green as the day is long. Even when it came to tipping the luggage people or tipping the door guys in a hotel, and, you know, Daryl, you know, was the first one to be like, look, I was like, hey, man, I'm in a hurry. He's like, it doesn't matter. Like, when we're about to leave a city, right, I'm always the first trip, I was just in a hurry and late and brought my bag down. He goes, look, you need to get ready earlier and call the bagman. That's how they make their money. And we're, trust me when I tell you this, the word goes around to each hotel. All these guys know each other. It's professional, and this is the way it's done. So I was like, okay, but just little things like that that you just don't think about. And, you know, really, like I said, just took me under his wing and showed me, you know, what it was to be a big leaguer. Whether it's going out to nice dinners and talking about the games and pitches and situations, he always, even though he had his own family, he always had time. He watched you pitch in your game. The next day or that night, we'd sit down and go, why'd you throw this pitch in this situation? What were you thinking here? This is what I saw. This is what I would have done. This is why. And he would go through that pitch after pitch, and I learned so much about the game, about being a young man. Really, I can't thank him enough. And he was having such an unbelievable season that, you know, we really got the best of Daryl Kyle. I mean, he was fun. There was always just all kind of different little games going on, whether it was made you look or trying to get you to say a specific word. Just little games that kept everybody in tune, and it made the camaraderie that much better. And I feel like it really did make our team just way closer than if he would not have been there.
And then Tony famously wanted you to pitch game one of the NLDS, but then sent Daryl down to do the media. What do you remember about that decision and how that played out and what Tony told you and told Daryl?
I remember thinking that, you know, Daryl, you know, he won 20 games that year. I remember thinking that, you know, it was probably his start to have. But, you know, historically, the Braves haven't been good against left-handers, and, you know, I kind of knew that going into it, too. So it was one of the things where, you know, like I said, Daryl took me under his wing where I was like, man, I hope he's not mad, but it's not like it was my decision, but that's kind of how I felt about it. And other than that, you know, really I felt, once again, like this is my chance to show the world who I am pitching against my childhood heroes, which were the Braves and Greg Maddux, and that's it, man. I remember thinking this is my time to shine and the Cardinals' time to shine. We had an unbelievable team, and it felt like, you know, we definitely had the talent to make a run and win the World Series that year. Just didn't play out that way.
That regular season, Rick, your runner up in Rookie of the Year voting. Did you feel like the body of work that you put out there in that 2000 season that maybe you should have been Rookie of the Year?
I definitely had a chance. You know, the biggest thing when I look at that year and think about it, look back, I went 10 straight starts without a decision. So, you know, I don't think any pitcher can expect to win the game every time coming out in the fifth inning, right? I throw 100 pitches, so maybe it's five or six innings, but you think you're going to win some of those, right? There were no decisions, so most of them I came out with the lead or we were tied. And if you look at my record, if I would have won all 10, it would have been 21-7. So, I definitely got better as the year went on, and You know, as far as rookie of the year, I don't know. I think maybe if I don't go through the throwing issues that I might have won it. Who knows? But regardless, you know, I thought it was a great rookie season, and I was just learning at that point in the big league. So there was a lot more room for improvement. And, you know, I wish I could have, you know, looking back, I wish I could have saw what an entire career of pitching would have looked like for me. But you know, those aren't the cards that were dealt to me, and sometimes you just got to play the best hand you can.
It is what it is. Yeah, and then you wrote the book, and willing to talk about anything and everything. Literally, you were an open book. Did you write that for others? Did you write it for yourself? I hear people every once in a while say, I wrote this for me. I needed to get it out there. What was the motivation for you with the book?
Honestly, it was more for others, because at the time, I really felt like, you know, I had talked about everything I'd been through enough, and I thought I had gotten everything out to where I felt, you know, comfortable and moved on. And, you know, people that I trust around me were really like, look, this is a great thing. You're going to be able to help a lot of people. You should do this. And, you know, looking back at it now, just thankfully I did. But at the same time, it was so therapeutic for me. So, I mean, personally, I definitely grew by doing it, and there was, I guess, some more stuff that I needed to get out. And honestly, even some of the closer people to me, and I mean that as far as like the players that I played with, you know, some of the managers that I played for, you know, everybody thinks they know you and they think they know the story. And then, you know, after writing the book, it really helped my relationship with a lot of people. I just think a lot of people were like, man, I thought I really knew it all and understood, but I kind of had no idea. And, you know, everything just makes a lot more sense now. So, and the feedback from all the people who, you know, said that they benefited from it was overwhelming. So I'm really glad I did the project.
I feel like I've heard Tony say over the years, like, some regret pitching you in that first game, but it wasn't like you were fine the first couple innings. So it wasn't the stage or the moment, right? I mean, it just, these things happen.
Right.
And have you guys ever talked about that game one, you and Tony, over the years?
You know, just kind of kicked it around. But yeah, nothing. I always go back to the way I feel. I'm like, this is nobody's fault, man. I had an unbelievable, that last month I was pitcher of the month. You know, and it was like I really started to figure some things out. So, like you said, the first few innings were fine. I just threw one pitch that got away, and for whatever reason, you know, it responded in the way that it came out, right? To start throwing balls, good control, things set up, so. You know, things happen. So, you know, things happen. It is what it is. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, after it happened, it's like, these are the cards that have been dealt, and I better figure out how to play this hand. So,
but the story is amazing, because you come back and become a big-time hitter then. Tell me about that decision in Jupiter. I know Walt played a role, and Tony obviously would have been there. Tell me about, and your agent probably is in the middle of that. How tough a call was it for you to say, all right, you know what, screw pitching. I'm going to do this as an outfielder.
Well, there were two parts, right? The first was I had to come to the realization that I just wasn't going to play baseball anymore. And that's really what happened. You know, everything that it was taking for me to be successful and compete and throw strikes was such a mental and physical grind that it just wasn't healthy. And I just got to the point where I understood if this is what this is going to be like for the next however long, I don't think it's worth it. And, you know, I walked into Tony's office one morning in spring training and said, hey, man, this is it. I've had enough. I can't do it. I need to move on. And, you know, he understood. And I went home that day, walked out of his office, walked out the back door, got my car, went home. Immediately, I felt like a giant weight was taken off my shoulders, felt like I could finally take a deep breath. I'm sitting at home, and then my agent calls, and it's like, hey, first, how you doing, blah, 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 and then second, are you ready to go play outfield? So I was like, what? Are you not hearing what's going on here, man? I just, like, it took everything I had to walk away from really the only thing I've ever loved, and you're talking about playing outfield. So he's like, no, I'm being serious. So I was like, listen, I got to call you back. I got to think about this. So I hung up and walked around the house trying to visualize what this is going to be, what it's going to look like, what it's going to take, everything that I could think of. And I found a bat. And all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of my living room, and I'm just by myself. The radio's not on. It's dead quiet. And I'm swinging a bat, and I visualize myself coming back and hitting a home run in the big leagues. And this overwhelming feeling came over me of like, this is right. This is, I can do this. This is going to happen. So I picked up the phone. I called him back. He goes, okay, let me call Walt. Walt calls me, and he's like, hey, we're in if you're in. I said, I'm in. He's like, all right, show up tomorrow. You're an outfielder. And that was that. I showed up that next day, and off my outfield career went. So, pretty fun journey.
Rick, the 2007 season for the Cardinals, not overly successful win-loss record-wise, but you come up to the club on August the 9th against the Padres, and it wasn't your first at-bat. I think it might have been maybe your third or fourth, and you hit the home run. Kind of walk us through that moment. I went back and watched it recently, and what stood out to me wasn't necessarily your reaction, but Tony's reaction in the dugout, one of pure jubilation that you never see out of Tony. I thought that spoke volumes about what that moment meant to everybody involved.
Yeah, no doubt. I think, for me, it's hard to describe the emotional roller coaster of it, but even for everyone, and the applause and the team, that when I walked into the clubhouse that day and the hugs and the high fives and welcome back was so genuine and deep and heartfelt. And, you know, everybody just felt like everybody was pulling for me. They understood, you know, the journey, what I'd been through, the odds of making it back, because nobody was giving me that chance, really. And I end up hitting a home run, which was, I've said this before, I felt like I floated around the bases. You know, looking back, the only thing I wish maybe I would have done different was maybe showed more emotion, right? I should have matched Tony's emotion. But, you know, in the moment, it was, I remember rounding second, and I'm looking at Cheo at third, Jose Kendo, and I'm thinking, oh my God, this just happened. Like, I just hit a homer on my first day back. So, you know, I couldn't have wrote a script any better. And then I'm passing home plate, and then the high fives in the dugout and the standing ovation. It was incredible. I could feel the ground shaking from everyone cheering. It was nuts.
You know, you were Ohtani, right? You were Shohei before Shohei. You could pitch, you could hit. I mean, that's a pretty rare feat. I know it's a pretty unique resume to have, having done both and done both well at the big league level. That's got to be pretty cool to think about.
It's definitely something that I can hang my hat on and be very proud of. There's no question. I mean, it's hard enough to make it once, and, you know, I can say I made it twice at two different positions and stayed there and played there and deserved to be there. And you're right. I'm very proud of that. And, you know, watching Shohei right now, what an incredible talent he is. And for me, watching it, I just think it's so good for the game of baseball and for little kids to look up and say and think, look, I can be a two-way player. I can play two positions. It's just, for me, it's really healthy for the game of baseball, and the fact that, you know, he's taking this globally because of the fans that he's bringing with him from home, and just what a good thing for the game.
What other sports did you play? Obviously you're a great athlete. It's amazing how many guys get to the big leagues, whether it's a Matt Holliday or whoever, and you're like, high school quarterback, high school running back. What else did you play, and did you excel? I think you're also, aren't you really good at fishing, deep-sea fishing too?
I love fishing. I'm definitely good at fishing. I don't know if I mean, it is a sport, but I won't call it an athletic sport, right? You know, I played a ton of that. As far as organized sports, baseball is really the only sport I ever played. But I played a ton of football in the neighborhood, a ton of basketball. But, you know, baseball, man, was honestly my thing. That's where I excelled.
Well, and I think the difference is in Florida, you can play baseball year-round. The rest of us are stuck indoors in December, January. But down there, yeah, you probably could play year-round.
Yeah, we could. We could, 100%.
And coming back as the broadcaster, we started with that. I'll end it for me with that. Being back around the stadium, seeing Aggie when you walk in, working with Dan. I mean, this organization, you literally grew up, the highs, the lows. Does it feel kind of full circle being back now on a regular basis?
It feels like home. It really does. Me and Danny were talking about this. Just even flying in, driving down the highway, I'm looking at things. It feels so familiar. You mentioned walking in and saying hi to Aggie. It's not even legal, so to speak, to walk in and not say hi to Aggie if you're passing through there. But, yeah, there's so many familiar faces, and, you know, I can feel so much support, and it's always great to be back. And I couldn't be more fortunate and thankful to have the opportunity to be with the broadcast and still be a part of the Cardinals organization.
Rick, I do have another question. In talking about Shohei Ohtani, as the two-way player, pitcher, DH. He makes the All-Star game, but he doesn't really play the field. They do use him in the outfield if they're kind of desperate. But you were not only an exceptional hitter, but you came up and brought plus defense to the outfield, and everybody remembers, or they should, the outfield assists, the throws that you made from Coors Field, I think in the same game, and I think both from around the warning track. Can you walk us through those two plays that happened? I think it was 2008, and they're still some of the more eye-popping outfield throws I think anybody's ever seen.
Yeah, so the first one, there was first and second, and Willie Taveras was on second, and he's fast. One of the fastest runners in the big leagues at the time. And usually in a situation like that where I set up in center field, if I have to go back, then I'm going to throw the ball to second base to keep the guy at first out of scoring position. I'll go ahead and let the guy from second tag up to third because I probably don't have a play. On that play, Todd Helton hit it. I started backing up. And I don't know, you just get feelings sometimes. You got to trust your gut every now and then, your instincts. And all of a sudden, I just had this feeling, even though I was backing up, I knew who the runner was. I just felt like I could throw him out. So I just let it rip. Thank goodness it was a perfect throw right to Troy Glock, who deked him, and we ended up getting the out. Because if I don't get the out, now you have second and third of runners in the scoring position with one out. That's not good baseball, I'll say, right? Not if you can limit damage and keep things at bay, especially in Coors Field. So that was one. And then the next one, there was nobody on. It was Omar Quintanilla was up, and I was playing on the right side of center field. He hit a ball in the left center gap. And as soon as he hit it, I knew, I got to go. So I took off sprinting. I didn't give up. I took off hauling butt, knowing that if I got there, there just might be a chance that I could unleash something and have a chance to get him at third. And sure enough, that's kind of how it went down. I let it go. And as soon as it came out of my hand, players know, we practice throws so much. I knew when it came out of my hand that it came out clean. I threw the ball as far as I possibly could, and I knew that I had a chance for it to be, on the money. So I'm watching the throw, looking at the runner. Once again, Troy did a great job of deking the guy, and he put the tag down. And when the umpire called him out, it was just a surreal moment, because as a player, you never know when your best game is going to come or your best moment's going to come. But in that moment, I knew I would never have a game like that where I made two unbelievable throws in one game, or even have the opportunity to make throws like that. But the fact that they were both on the money, I knew right then that was going to be my best game as throwing guys out that I could have.
And that, we all know Coors Field, a lot of home runs, thin air and whatnot. That's a big ballpark, spacious outfield, right? I mean, that adds to the degree of difficulty, I think, on those throws.
100%. That's a huge outfield. I get a kick out of it just looking at when I'm watching TV. The ball goes into that gap, and I think, man, that's where my best throw came from. Yeah. So it's always fun. The team was just there. It's fun watching them when they're in Colorado because I get to relive some of those moments. It's pretty fun.
Really a lot of fun to hear from Rick Ankiel, who is just literally the open book, talking about his life. He wrote a book, and just so open and honest about whatever you want to talk about. And this year is the first year he's actually in the booth doing games with Dan. He's been doing the pre- and post-game analyst role for a little while now, but just seems to be a natural calling the games, just having fun and yucking it up with Dan. So good to have Rick back in town more often. I know our friend Aggie down there, Aggie's Entrance. She's been there for a million years at Busch Stadium. She gets so excited when she sees Rick walking through. And it is, like he said, sort of a homecoming, bringing things full circle. So appreciate his time that he gave us on KTRS, myself and Brendan Weesey. The conversation recently featured there on their Legends series, but wanted to make sure you all heard the extended comments of a Cardinal name that is certainly iconic when you just say the name Rick Ankiel, because so much goes into what his career has been about. The Kilcoin Conversation, always available on Spotify, iTunes, all the segments posted at scoopswithdannymac.com. Make sure you check out Dan's website. So much great content on a daily basis. Lots of Cardinals coverage. Our visits with Keith Kachuk, hanging with Big Walt, all of our past Kilcoin Conversations posted there as well. Scoops with DannyMac.com. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes or Spotify, and that way All of our segments are delivered directly to you. We're brought to you by the good folks at Appliance Discounters, theappliancediscounters.com. Get that appliance brand new in a couple of days. All the excitement of buying something, you don't want to wait weeks or months. Check them out, theappliancediscounters.com. B&G Tuck Pointing, it's a family-run business, and nothing tells that more than the B and the G. That's Bella and Gabrielle, Gabby. That's the daughters of the owner, Rich Galati. It's a family operation. BGTuckPointing.com, a free estimate, whether you need tuck pointing, the mortar repair, foundation, waterproofing, 363-0525, 314-363-0525. And Triad Bank, neighborhood-friendly bank. They should be friendly, right? You're going to the bank, it's your money, but they definitely are that at Triad Bank, St. Louis-based bank since 2005. TriadBanking.com. And, of course, Marie Davila, the place for senior living, corner of Clayton and Wideman Road, beautiful campus in West County. Thanks to Marie Davila for also being a longtime sponsor of the Kilcoin Conversation. We'll talk to you again soon. Look, no, right on cue, we got a boat going by out in the water. Kids wailing away. Honestly, it's about 120 degrees right now. Looking forward to getting out on that water and cooling off. Hope you're having a great summer. We'll talk soon.